Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Award-winning NPR journalist Jack Speer is in town to moderate a panel, but he has stopped by St. Louis Public Radio to talk about his craft and the challenges it faces. Jack, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Don. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to St. Louis.
Yeah, it's a great city, and I've been here a few times, so it's not my first trip.
What are you here for this time, a medical panel of some sort?
Yeah, I did the CEO to CEO panel for Accelerate St. Louis last night, and it was really a pretty interesting discussion. We had Anthony Tersini, who's the CEO of Ascension, which is a pretty big healthcare provider.
Oh, yeah.
And a young guy named Blake Margraf, who's a CEO of basically a startup, an online startup that looks at the idea of using your mobile phone as sort of a medical diagnostic tool. So your doctor will send you a text and say, did you take your medicine today? How are you feeling? What are your symptoms? And so they're both sort of on the cutting edge of medicine. And obviously medicine and healthcare is a huge topic these days, especially in Washington with the recent deal with the ACA.
Yeah, we can get into a little more detail on that. But I wanted to talk to you a bit about the mood in Washington these days. I mean, it's difficult for one person to assess an entire group. And I'm curious as to what the mood of journalists in general is. I mean, is there a sense of frustration or a sense that we've got to buckle up and really pay attention to what this Trump administration is doing?
I think buckle up and pay attention is a pretty good description. Yeah. I would guess that I would say every day is kind of a new adventure here. I mean, we start the morning with the Twitter feeds from the White House and from President Trump, and we sort of try to read the tea leaves there and ascertain what we're talking about and what's being discussed and what the position really is and whether that's the position of the administration or his position. And we kind of start there at early morning and keep going. And every day has been sort of an adventure for the last, almost 100 days.
Almost
100
days
yet? Close.
Well, everybody's counting because, and apparently the Trump administration is too, because it wants to have some sort of a success or something you can point to as a great success during those first couple of months.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose they'll probably look at Syria as some part of his success. Not so successful in terms of the healthcare and some other issues they've had mixed success with. So it's been a mixed first 100 days.
Is it harder to do the job in Washington? Access has been somewhat limited. You're dealing with the Twitter feeds, and you're dealing with a group of people who say basically that the media is the enemy.
Right. Well, I think there are challenges, obviously, there. The biggest challenge, I think, is the media is the enemy idea and the First Amendment to some extent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that is a big challenge. I don't think the access is necessarily that much more challenging. Interestingly enough, we did not have much more access with the Obama White House. That was a very controlled press environment also. So I think the press environment that we deal with as journalists has existed in its current form really for quite a while. I mean, the message has been pretty tightly controlled all the time. And I think our White House people, who we have some great White House correspondents, by the way, Scott Horsley, a bunch of other people who do a tremendous job for us. But I think they are in a bubble, and sometimes it's difficult to actually get out of that bubble and find out, beyond what the White House creates, what's really going on, which is why I think we have so many other correspondents doing so many other things, and why I think public radio is so valuable.
Well, valuable indeed. But I have to imagine there are some people wondering what the future of public broadcasting is, given, again, the new administration's
I don't know, Don. I mean, I think we've faced this before, though. This is not the first time that that public broadcasting has faced this threat. And I think public broadcasting will be just fine. I think we provide a vital service. I think people rely on us to give them the news. I think they rely on us to give them the national news and also the local news that you do here in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And I think those services are vital, and I think they'll continue.
No apparent nervousness in-house then?
Well, there's always we're always watching what's going on. We have but we have friends on Capitol Hill too.
Do you have the opportunity at all to attend the daily briefings with Mr. Spicer?
I haven't, but I obviously watch the daily briefings, which is pretty much the same thing as almost being there in some ways. We have usually Scott or sometimes Mara Liasson will be there. Yeah. I certainly watched the daily briefings. He certainly had his learning curve, as any press secretary will have. And I think he did some things wrong in the beginning. I think he's learned from some of his mistakes. He's getting a little better at it. But that's a difficult job for anyone to do. So
my understanding is that the daily briefings get higher ratings during the early afternoon on television than do the soap operas.
Of course, that's interesting. I think a lot of people are tuned in. They want to know what's going on. This administration doesn't necessarily have the highest approval rating, but I think people are interested in what they're doing and their ideas for the country, which of course are different than some previous administrations. So I think people want to know what's happening. I think they feel more empowered when they can tune in and at least see what's happening and what's going on.
The media in general is really going through a very interesting period these days, not only because of what we're talking about, what's going on in Washington, but it's become a totally different world. Now, you've been around
Absolutely.
For a while, and you've seen the change into the digital era.
Yep.
What do you make of that? Are we reporting better? Are we better at what we're doing because of that?
So I do some teaching, and I teach at Johns Hopkins, and I teach business students. And one of the things, because they always ask me, you know, how do I get into journalism? How do I get into, you know, get on the radio, do television, and all these things? And I say, you don't do it the way I did it, because I started in a small market and went to the next market and, you know, started in Erie, Pennsylvania, and then I went to Cleveland, and then I went to New Jersey, and then I went to Washington, D.C. local, and then I went to network. And that path, for the most part, except maybe to some extent Stone Public Radio, doesn't exist in quite the same way it did when I started. But I say, of course, you have a huge advantage over me in the fact that you have the internet, which obviously changed everything, and digital. And the fact is that I tell them, your iPhone has more power than the first television station I worked for. The first television station I worked for was in Erie, Pennsylvania, again, small town, probably millions of dollars of equipment, transmitters, towers, cameras that cost $50,000 to $75,000 a piece. You know, they used to tell us when we went out on the story, we'd go out in a boat or something, you know, don't come back if you drop that camera over the side. Right. But, you know, they can shoot all this stuff with an iPhone, and they can do it in HD, which we didn't even have. And they can broadcast it over the internet in real time, just like a television station. Ooh. I mean, the power that you have at your disposal because of digital is just – it's really kind of mind-blowing.
You know, when I started in television, it was a long time ago, granted, but you'd go out on a story, you'd carry 600 pounds of equipment with you, cameras and tripods and lights and all
that. You probably had three guys. You probably had a sound guy.
That's right. That's right. And now you can carry it in the palm of your the palm of your hand.
And it's really, when you think about that aspect of it's just remarkable.
Not to mention the power that the cell phone has had in the hands of non-journalists. Mm-hmm. Who have created so much news over the last couple of years with regard to police shootings, for instance, and some of the things that have gotten so much attention.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's changed the face of our business. And as I mentioned, I was talking with these two healthcare people last night, and it's changing their business. I mean, the fact that you can now have a conversation with your doctor through your cell phone, and he can say, well, did you take your medicine? How are you feeling today? What are your symptoms? It's a diagnostic tool that was never really envisioned before. You know, you had to go see the doctor and you had to sit and wait till the doctor had time to see you. And now you can do it back and forth kind of seamlessly.
Yeah, we've done some programs in the past with some students at Washington University who are working on that kind of diagnostic equipment with some very sophisticated disease, diabetes, for instance.
Right.
And your telephone can tell you when to do a lot of things and when not to do a lot of things.
Which in the past was kind of your doctor told you, but maybe you did it right, maybe you didn't. Maybe you remembered, maybe you didn't. And now there are things on your phone that can remind you and that can tell you, you know, your alarm can go off and it's time to take your medicine, and another alarm can go off and it's time to call or email. And so I think, you know, to answer, kind of get back here in the circle, I think it's changed dramatically, but not all for the some it's partly for the better and maybe some things not so great.
What are some of the not-so-great things, do you think?
Well, I think sometimes the immediacy doesn't lend itself to great thought. In other words, to put it more simply, we tend to react rather than think about what we're doing sometimes. And this is a problem you see on social media a lot. You see people doing things on social media that they might not otherwise do. You see journalists doing this too. And every once in a while, someone at NPR or within our organization puts out something on social media that they probably shouldn't have because they didn't sit down and take the 5 seconds or 15 seconds to say, wait a minute, should I actually really do this? And it doesn't necessarily lend itself to as much thought and investigation as maybe some of the journalism that I
– And editorial control.
And editorial control.
The firewalls are quite different than they used to be. So
people can get to you who couldn't get to you before because you don't have, quote unquote, you know, I mean, my college journalism paper was written about gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty quaint right now, right?
Sure.
The whole idea of the gatekeeper in media. I mean, that was the person who basically controlled the news that went in. That's almost a non-existent function. Then.
On the other hand, it's an invaluable tool for reporters out in the field and even
absolutely
inside who are getting information as their stories are developing.
Yes, I said, the first thing I read are the Twitter feeds from the White House in the morning.
Yeah, well, so. Of course, the president has made that an absolute necessity, no question about it. But to take a break, we're talking with Jack Spear of NPR. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to have a word or two with Jack, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you would prefer a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back with Jack Spear in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back to NPR's Jack Spear. Jack, we were talking before we went on the air about Facebook and the role it's playing and the fact that NPR has been kind of fiddling with it a little
we
bit.
Have. We have.
What has been going on? I'm not sure that everybody's fully aware of this.
Well, we've been doing this and so have a number of other media outlets. The New York Times, I think, has done it. We do a certain amount of content for Facebook. Actually, it has been a fairly large amount of content. And I was doing the 5 o'clock news every day on Facebook Live. Mm-hmm. I would just do my newscast. And then they would turn to me and ask me questions for about 10 minutes after I did it. Mostly questions about the stories, but some questions also from the audience. Mm. So we've done that for a while. I think Facebook has already decided it's not as interested in the news portion of this whole thing and wants to go more to the entertainment side. But we have been doing this. So it's an interesting idea. It's a new use of social media and a use of Facebook Live in a different way.
An awful lot is going on, in terms of trying to figure out how to most effectively use all that's available out there through social media, through the internet, through
absolutely
this digital world again.
A lot of experimentation, and Facebook Live with news is definitely in their minds, and I think in ours too, a bit of an experiment, and I think parts of it have worked really well and some things less well.
What about the pressure on the newscaster? I mean, they're coming back and asking questions about stories that you have just read, but not necessarily covered per se.
Correct.
Yeah.
So there's a balance there, and some of our people are more comfortable with it than others. Corva Coleman does it in the morning. She does a fantastic job. I did it in the evening. For a while. I don't know that we're going to continue doing it. I was fine with it, but I came from some television background too, so it bothered me less. And the real idea about the Facebook Live is if you don't know, if it's not something that you're comfortable talking about and you haven't covered it, then you just say, hey, you know what? I didn't cover that. I'm really not comfortable talking about it. But there are plenty of things, news stories that people would ask me about that I know enough about that I could talk about. But, I mean, you would get some crazy questions too. You know, you'd get questions like, what is that baffling in the studio? Well, fortunately, since I know a little bit about acoustics, I explained what the baffling was for. But, I mean, you would get – and then you'll get, you know, the kind of like what's your favorite food and weird questions like that.
You know, it's funny. I look back on my days in television and the most response we ever got to anything was when the anchor woman changed her hairstyle.
Right. And people would say – yeah, it's like when people would say, oh, well, you know, I saw you on television last night. Yeah. and you had a really nice tie. And I would always say, oh, do you remember, you know, what was I doing? What was I – oh, I don't know what you were talking about, but you had a nice tie. So they would remember, like, what you were wearing, but they had no – if you asked them what the news story was.
Well, neither one of us has to worry about the nice tie today or in most days with
that's
radio,
true.
That's for sure. We have a caller who wants to get into the conversation. Let's bring him in. It's Jerry from O'Fallon, who calls us with some regularity. Jerry, nice to talk to you again.
Noon. My question is, just the most recent example, when you have someone saying a blatant lie that goes unchallenged. I think that the gatekeeper concept is alive and well, and it's the subject who will – it's almost like People magazine. If you don't write a fawning review, you'll lose the access to the subject. And the recent example is the comparison of the legalization of marijuana with the opioid crisis. You know, we have thousands of people. I mean, that's becoming a rival to traffic deaths, the deaths of people from opioid overdoses. And to my knowledge, there's yet to be a single overdose of a person using marijuana. And yet, that statement is issued, and it goes unchallenged. I can't think of a single person, much less a news organization, that has made the public aware of that fact. And I'll just take your comment off here. Thank you.
I can respond to that fairly quickly. One thing I would say jumps at me immediately is that gatekeeper and gateway are two different things. When I'm talking about gatekeepers, I'm talking about access to journalists and reporters. And the old traditional gatekeeper of a media outlet was the editor, who basically decided whether you were going to do a story or not do a story. And with social media, that has sort of been sidestepped. Twitter feeds, Facebook, all these other social media platforms let newsmakers and others who want to get news coverage sort of bypass some of the traditional channels and use other channels. So I'm not sure exactly what his question was, but I think he was confusing my comment about gatekeeper and gateway, which are two different things.
Yeah. What do you see looking ahead, Jack, as the challenges people who do what you do in Washington are going to be having to deal with?
Well, I mean, the technology is always a challenge. Yeah. The ability to manipulate and control the message is always a challenge. I mean, that's our biggest challenge. I mean, we have to realize that everybody wants to control the message the way they want to control it. And social media lets you do some of those things. It lets you come up with ways to craft in 140 characters or less in some instances what you want your message to be. But it's our job to look beyond that 140 characters and say, okay, is this true? Is it not true? Is it partially true? What does it mean? What are the longer-term ramifications of this? And how do we have an informed citizenry that understands what this means in a bigger context? Yeah. And I think that's our challenge.
Yeah, I wonder how well-informed the citizenry is if it's just relying on the 140 characters and Facebook, if you will.
Right, right. Well, I think that's part of our job, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be doing. That's why we're here. That's basically what a free press is supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be informing the citizenry about issues and governance and government. And I think we're trying very hard to do that. I think when you point out that this administration early on has decided that the press is, quote, the enemy of the people, mm-hmm. I don't think I feel like the enemy of the people. I think I feel like I'm doing a job that's important and that needs to be done. And hopefully along the way some people will learn a few things not know.
I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said the greatest threat to democracy is an uninformed electorate.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that, of course, is our job, is to see that they are informed. We have a tweet here I'd like to read to you from Alonzo, who writes, how has the NPR Corporation shakeup a few years ago affected the news coverage capabilities?
Like any other organization, we've had our growing pains. We've gone through things. But I will tell you that NPR now, I think, and I've been there 20 years, so I've seen all these changes, I think is stronger than it's ever been. I think we're reaching a broader audience than we've ever reached. I think we do more in-depth features and more in-depth coverage of different types of news. And, of course, using different platforms that we never had before. We do more podcasts. We have some of the highest rated podcasts in the country. We do better news coverage. We have better, of course, we have more foreign correspondents than almost anyone at this point. And I think we've grown. And, yes, there are growing pains in organization as you get bigger and as your mission broadens and as you have more people to manage.
Part of that broadening of the mission is the fact that you can't really exist in broadcasting today without having an internet, a website, a capability to reach the audience that way. And also enhance the reporting with video and graphics that weren't available.
Absolutely. Right. So, you know, the joke was, why were we hiring photographers when we were in radio? Well, because we needed good quality photographs for our web pages. Mm-hmm. And the correspondents were doing that for a while. And some of our correspondents are better than others at mm-hmm. taking pictures. Yeah. So we got professional.
How do you see the collaboration between the mothership, if you will, and the local stations?
It's vitally important. It is the most important thing we do. And that has changed too. I think for a while there was this kind of attitude about, you know, well, we're the NPR Washington network and, you know. And I think we've suddenly – not even suddenly. I think over the last decade we've decided that our whole future depends on member stations. Member stations are of vital importance to NPR itself. Without member stations, you know, however many we have now, 800 or 900 different outlets that are carrying our product, we would be nothing. So I think we really have a big appreciation of that.
You know, we have I think in general – the media missed the boat during the last presidential campaign because I don't think it really had its finger on the pulse of the heartland, which turned out to be the voting block that made Donald Trump president. But with the collaboration we have between NPR and the member stations, mm-hmm. you really get a sense of that heartbeat, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no question that a lot of people in the media were taken by surprise by the outcome of that election. But I think without, again, the finger on the pulse, as you kind of put it, we really need to know what's happening in all our different operations. And, you know, it's part of the reason I'm happy to be here. And I've seen St. Louis, but I hadn't been here before. So I get to see, you know, what goes on here at St. Louis Public Radio. And I think it's really important that we know what our member stations are doing.
Let me take another call
sure.
here. Christine joins us here in St. Louis. Go ahead, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi. Several years ago, Jack and I were part of a group of so-called influential journalists who were invited for a long, all-expenses-paid weekend at a fancy club on Martha's Vineyard.
It's a long time ago.
To listen to sort of free market experts from the University of Chicago and George Mason University try to co-opt our views of the best way to regulate or deregulate the economy. And the seminar we were on was underwritten in part by the Olin School of Business at Washington U,
right.
which we now know, thanks to Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money, has received some dark money. So Jack and I were really at the leading edge of this organized, decades-long campaign to brainwash the mainstream media to adopt the political views of the sort of the American oligarchy, like the Mercers and the Koch brothers. And at the time, it seemed like an innocent educational opportunity / junket, and it now looks like something much more sinister. And I wondered what Jack's view of this is in hindsight.
Well, you know, I view a lot of those things maybe not as sinister as that. I mean, I went to that seminar. I think it was with the Weidenbaum facility in Cape Cod, if I remember. And mostly it was tools about business journalism. And I've done some of those. I did one at the Wharton School also, which, by the way, was probably even more in some ways sinister because it turned out it was underwritten by Enron. And also on the panel with me was Jason Blair, who is a New York Times reporter maybe you've heard of.
Oh, yes.
The infamous Jason Blair. So, yeah, I've been to a few of those seminars, and there are valuable things about the Wharton seminar that you got about accounting and some other things, which as a business journalist I found useful. And I think you're right. You have to look at some of these things. Yes, some of these seminars and some of these things that are put on by people will have an agenda. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you as a reporter have to go back and report anything about it. I don't think I reported anything out of either one of those seminars I attended. I did get some accounting out of the Wharton seminar, and I got – actually, I think there was some accounting in the Weidenbaum one as well.
We should point out, by the way, for those who don't recall, that Jason Blair was a New York Times reporter who fabricated some material for an extended period of mm-hmm. time before he was finally caught and fired.
Yeah, it had to do with the shootings that were going on. Remember the random shootings in Washington, D.C.?
That's right, yeah.
But, you know, that being said, even the perhaps more sinister part was that it was sponsored by Enron, which, of course, no longer exists.
Well, that's true. But the Mercers do and the Cokes
yes,
do. And
that's
they're
true.
Still out
absolutely.
There with free reign to
but
spend a lot of money.
As a journalist, everyone is always trying to influence you in some way or another. So your job as a journalist is to be an independent arbiter of the facts. So whether somebody's trying to influence you through seminars or other things, I mean, you basically – you know, unless you're taking money from someone, which of course is unethical, I don't think a seminar one way or the other is going to change how I view the world as a journalist.
Well, we certainly hope not. Jack, we're going to have to let it go at that. Our time is up. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, and welcome to St. Louis and goodbye.
Thanks so much. Yes, I'm leaving in a couple hours, but it's been great, and thank you for having me.
It's been our pleasure. Hope to see you again soon. Right. That's Jack Spear of NPR. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.